Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Hello, good evening. Welcome to Interchange. I'm your host, Ryan Dawes. Tonight we discuss the inescapable dependence on oil and how oil is distributed across nations and backyards. Joining me in the Firehouse Studios is Sam Avery, energy activist and author of the book, The Pipeline and the Paradigm, Keystone XL, Tar Sands, and the Battle to Defuse the Carbon Bomb. Sam Avery, thank you very much for joining us here on Interchange.
It's good to be here, Brian.
Now, Sam, we've intercepted you en route home to Louisville from Indianapolis, where you recently spoke about the Keystone Pipeline and the sociological and environmental effects of petroleum dependence. Talk about, in your travels, promoting your book and this cause, talk about what has been your main message. If somebody walks away from one of your talks, what is something you hope that they walk away from, whether it's just an idea or maybe even a behavior change?
Well, the reason I wrote this book and the reason I traveled the route of the Keystone XL pipeline is that this is not just another environmental issue. This is not just a jobs versus the environment kind of thing. This is the environmental issue of our time. And the reason for that is that the Keystone XL pipeline has become a symbol of the fossil fuel industry as a whole. And it has become a symbol of opposition to further degradation of the climate and of the environment in general. And this single piece of infrastructure, because it's so visible, because it crosses our highways and our rivers and it's in our backyards, we can see it, we can touch it, it's going to become a battleground where opposing forces are going to meet. Now, I don't really enjoy talking about opposing forces and battlegrounds. I would much rather this was the type of issue where people could sit around a table and voice their views and come up with some sort of resolution. But for this particular issue, that's not going to happen because we're not talking about opinions here. We're not talking about individual views. We're talking about fundamental worldviews. And that's what's going to line up on either side of this issue. Now, what I mean by that is that people who have feelings either way about this pipeline base those feelings on very fundamental assumptions about the purpose of human life. It's that deep. It's that big. For instance, if you talk to people who are supporters of the pipeline, the reasons they give are things like jobs, investment opportunities, economic growth, more energy into the economy, and so forth and so on. And those are all legitimate. They're true. They tend to inflate these things. Of course, any kind of investment will produce jobs. You could, with a solar farm or a wind installation, that would also produce jobs.
But their arguments are hard to argue with.
In fact, we shouldn't argue with them because it is true that this is going to produce jobs. Not very many, not for very long. It's going to produce enormous new investment opportunities, and it's going to bring about 830,000 barrels a day of oil into not the American economy necessarily, but at least into the world economy. So it is going to have positive economic effects. But here's the big but. If we build this pipeline for those reasons, it will be because our understanding of our place in the natural world is limited by what I call the economic paradigm. This is what I mean by fundamental assumptions and fundamental worldview. A paradigm is a fancy word for a worldview. Okay?
Sure.
And the assumptions underneath the economic paradigm are that we are here basically for the purpose of making the economy grow. And it doesn't matter really where it grows or how it grows, it just has to grow. That's the assumption behind really the prevailing paradigm of our society. And the way we make the economy grow is through fostering consumer demand, meeting consumer demand, doing whatever we have to do to extract resources from the earth and consume them in order to meet human consumer demand. We don't question consumer demand. We don't try to shape it. We don't try to do anything to it other than to feed it. So essentially, in our relation to the natural world, we are following our appetite rather than our intelligence. Okay? So what's happening now with new information coming in, we're beginning to see there's things happening in the natural world which don't fit into this paradigm. Things like hot summer days, melting glaciers, melting ice caps, more intense weather systems, droughts, so forth and so on. And as this new information comes in, it doesn't fit into the prevailing worldview. We don't know what to do with it. We can't run a cost-benefit analysis on climate change. What happens is we're beginning to see the growth and development of an entirely new paradigm, a new set of assumptions, a new worldview that I call the ecologic worldview. And that is one in which life comes before money. It's about all forms of life, about all people everywhere. And it doesn't reject the economy. We still need the economy. We still need jobs. We need money. But it puts the economy inside the ecology. It puts human economic activity alongside the forests and the oceans and the atmosphere and the climate and so forth and so on. It puts us inside a larger context where what we do for our economic purposes takes on a more of an organic nature, because an economy works pretty much the way a living organism works. So if we can see ourselves that way and fit ourselves into the larger picture, we have a much better chance of survival.
So in your words, we don't necessarily have to abandon this universal priority of economic development as a human goal everywhere. We would just have to change how we go about accomplishing that goal.
We would have to abandon it as a first priority. We would have to say the purpose of human life is not just to see how much economy we can grow. The purpose of human life is to promote life itself and to take the human activities and coordinate them into a larger picture that involves many other forms of life. And even economic growth, we can have economic growth. We need economic growth. It's a question of how we grow economically. It's a question of what kind of infrastructure are we going to build. Now, the Keystone XL pipeline is tapping in to the second largest fossil fuel deposit on planet Earth. It's enormous. The tar sands region in Alberta, Canada is huge. And the amount of tar sand there is measured in the trillions of barrels. Not millions, not billions, but trillions of barrels. And there's enough carbon in that tar sand deposit to send the Earth's climate into an irreversible tailspin.
Meaning if all of that oil in the tar sands deposits in Alberta were burned, it would
send the Earth into a runaway climate situation, which would make life questionable in the coming generations for plants, animals, and people.
Is that possible for us to consume those trillions of barrels that you say are there?
Yes. I mean, it would be possible. It would take a long time. And it's not going to happen in isolation. It's important to realize that this deposit alone is probably enough to ruin the climate. But we don't have to worry about that because it's not going to work alone. We still have other deposits in Saudi Arabia, which is the biggest. There's an equal-sized tar sands deposit in Venezuela. And according to recent figures that have come out in the last year or so, around the world, we have way more fossil fuel in proven reserves around the planet than we need to ruin the climate. See, it used to be we thought we were running out of fossil fuel. We thought that as time went on, the supplies are going to get lower, we're going to run out of oil, we're going to run out of natural gas.
What we would call peak oil.
Peak oil, yeah. But what has happened in the last few years is companies, instead of investing in renewable energy, have invested and developed new technologies and new sources of fossil fuel. Examples of that are the Canadian tar sands, fracking. You know, we didn't know we had all this natural gas. All of a sudden, we have these enormous supplies. Natural gas is a fossil fuel. It's not as bad as coal or oil, but it's a fossil fuel.
With carbon emissions.
Yes. Natural gas is methane, which is a carbon atom surrounded by four hydrogen atoms. So it doesn't get as much of its energy from carbon as coal or petroleum does, but it's still carbon-based. So all of these new technologies that have come out in the last year or so mean that totally changed the picture for humanity's survival on the Earth, because we used to think that as fossil fuel supplies got low, the price would rise, they would get too expensive, we'd have to develop renewable energies just because they'd be cheaper. But that's not going to happen, because we have so much, we have 3 to 5 times as much fossil fuel now available to us than we would need to ruin the climate. And that totally changes what it means to be a human being, because we have to consciously decide and figure out how we're going to get off of fossil fuel without the market mechanism, without the economy coming in and saving us by making it too expensive. So all of a sudden, there has to develop a new direction of human civilization on the planet.
Now, I'd like to talk about the environmental cost of not coming up with a new direction. But first, I want to paint a picture for the listeners as to what the pipeline looks like and what these tar sands mining operations look like in Canada and the northern part of the U.S. I've heard them described, they're almost the modern Wild West of men showing up for quick, enormous amounts of money. I hear what are described as man camps, and it's young to middle-aged men working tons and tons of hours. They get a short amount of time off, and they get tons and tons of money. You hear stories of McDonald's paying people $14 an hour to work in Williston, North Dakota, or Fort McMurray, Alberta. Talk a little bit about what these communities look like, what the process of extracting tar sands, because it's not just a pipe shoved into the ground like you see in Texas, those revolving wells that you see next to the interstate. They're massive. You can see them, as you mentioned earlier, before we spoke on the air, you said you could see them from space. Talk a little bit about what this type of this extraction process does to the environment, and what do you notice? What have you heard people who live and engage with this on an economic perspective, what do they say about these areas?
Well, I did spend some time in Fort McMurray and interviewed people. I've interviewed a lot of the First Nation people, the Indigenous people, and Dene and Cree, whose land is being taken over by these tar sands extraction industries. And I also spent a little time bar hopping and talking to workers and seeing what their side of the situation was like. First of all, I should describe the mining process itself. The tar sands are a solid at room temperature. They're black, they're sticky, they're tar with sand in them. That's why they're called tar sands.
Meaning it's not automatically going to flow up simply because
it doesn't
flow. Pipe.
It doesn't flow. You can't make it move in a pipeline without treating it. The promoters of the tar sands don't call them tar sand. They call them oil sands, which has a nicer sound to it. But they're black and they're sticky. They quack. They're a duck. They're tar. Believe me. I've held it in my hand, and it's there's nothing oily. It has a little bit of an oily feel to it, but it's really sticky, nasty looking stuff. To extract this stuff, the original tar sands mines and that are still being used now are surface mines. That is, they have to eliminate the surface in order to get at. They're strip mine, essentially. So the boreal forest, which is a pretty rich ecosystem in the northern parts of Canada, has to be completely stripped bare. They remove all the trees, all the soil, every bug, every leaf, every bacterium, everything is destroyed, and so that the tar sands can be dug out from underneath. They're extracted by heavy machinery. They're moved back to processing facilities in the largest trucks in the world. They have tires that are 11 feet high. And the size of these mines are enormous. That's what you can see from space. If you Google up Fort McMurray and look around the area, you see these huge white former tar sands mines, which are, a lot of them are turned into settlement ponds where they bring water in from the Athabasca River and try to wash these sands out in order to extract some of the impurities. And these ponds don't evaporate. They just sit there year after year after year. And they're huge toxic ponds, essentially. The other form of extraction is called the in situ method, which does not destroy as much of the surface. It's a process. It's like fracking, in which they drill a vertical shaft and then horizontal shafts going out from that. And they have to use enormous amounts of natural gas to heat the tar sand up to turn it into a liquid form so that it can be extracted and brought up through the horizontal and then up through the vertical shafts. Now, it doesn't destroy the surface as much, but the surface is cut up with pipelines, access roads, buildings, and so forth and so on. So the forest is fragmented, it's chopped up. And actually 80% of the tar sand is now extracted through this method. So it's extremely destructive of something like caribou herds or any sort of natural wildlife has a very difficult time surviving in this kind of fragmented environment. And the people who naturally live in this area, the Cree and Dene peoples, are suffering enormously from this massive intrusion into their natural habitat, and the world that they knew is being destroyed, and the water they depend on is being polluted by these settling ponds, and the huge cancer rates. There's deformations in the fish and the wildlife up there, so these people really can't carry on their traditional ways of life.
Now, where do we see the water contamination and the cancer rates? What is that a direct result of?
Well, you know, it would seem to be a direct result of this massive tar sand mining that's going on.
But are there certain chemicals involved that are leaking into the water system? Or
yeah.
How is that working?
Well, in order to make the tar sand flow, they have to add chemicals to it, like naphtha and benzene. And there's a whole brew of chemicals that we're not allowed to know about because this is supposedly a trade secret and proprietary knowledge. So they don't let people know the kind of things they add to it. But they have to add chemicals to the tar sand to make them flow, to give them a certain liquidity so that they will flow in a pipeline. Once they get the pipeline, the tar sand flowing in a pipeline, interestingly, it produces its own heat through abrasion because there's still sand in it. They try to extract as much sand as they can, but there's still sand in it. And once it starts flowing, it heats up, and that helps keep it in a liquid form. But that's a lot of people are worried about the abrasiveness of the tar sand in the pipeline. The pipeline is only less than half an inch thick. And a lot of people who live along the route of the pipeline are very concerned about this pipeline deteriorating rather rapidly and breaking and spilling millions of gallons of tar sand all over their land. which has already happened many times, as we know. So that's the major concern of people who live along the route of where this pipeline is being built.
We have an idea of what the mines look like that obtain the tar sands. Talk about what the pipeline itself looks like. You said it's about a half inch thick. How big in diameter?